This week on Family Anatomy, Anatomy of Mental Health.
Hosts of Family Anatomy are psychologists, but they're not your psychologists. So if you want to talk to someone about family or mental health issues, you can get a referral from your family doctor. This show is for information only.
Welcome to Family Anatomy, your source for parenting and relationship information, with your hosts, Dr. Giuseppe Spazzano
and Dr. Brian McDonald. And this is episode 99, the episode with the most general, generic title possible, Anatomy of Mental Health. Two psychologists talk about mental health in under 30 minutes. Go!
Oh boy, oh boy, oh boy. It's not going to be all about us, though. We're going to have a guest on the show.
That's
Dr.
true.
Michael Cheng.
He's a child psychiatrist who works at a local children's hospital, and we've heard him talk a few times. He actually has a couple of websites with great information for parents and even links to resources if they're looking for help with a mental health issue. So Dr. Michael Cheng is his name, and we're going to get him on the line.
Let's do it. And now we'd like to welcome Dr. Michael Cheng to the show. Hello, Michael.
Hello, everyone.
It's nice to have you on the podcast and to join us here. You're a psychiatrist in the city at the Children's Hospital, and you're also an assistant professor of psychiatry at University of Ottawa. And I guess, I mean, you have a lot of years of experience working with kids and families, but tell us a little bit about your background and how you came to focus on working with kids and families.
Well, I must say I'm very happy to be on the show, and I appreciate all the excellent work you guys have done over the years in educating people about children's mental health. So in terms of my background and why I got interested in this, I've always been interested in mental health and in working with adults with mental health issues. It became obvious that most of the time people's issues start when they're younger. And unfortunately, most of the time when people are younger and they have issues, they often don't realize they have an issue, or there's actually a shortage of resources to help people when they're younger. So I realized it made a lot more sense to just work with the young, because if we can intervene before their issues become bigger issues when they're adults, we have the chance to make a much more bigger impact.
And it's usually, well, very often it's the parents who are bringing kids into your office, I'm sure.
That's right.
Sometimes I think it's hard for parents to know, you know, is this just a normal part of it, my child growing up, or is there something more, is there a problem here that needs to be addressed? Are there warning signs, do you think, that parents should look for?
Basically, you can think that there's this concept of normal development, and there's this concept of what a normal child should be able to do for their age. And if a child seems to have difficulties doing what we would normally expect a child to do, then that might be a warning sign. For example, we expect a child to be able to go to school, enjoy school, make friends, be social, be able to do well at school. So if a child is unable to do any of these things, then that's a warning sign maybe there's something wrong.
And so in your practice, what are the most common problems or difficulties that you get confronted with when parents bring their kids in?
Well, one of the most common problems that we will see is troubles with anxiety. So this might range from a young child who has troubles with separation anxiety to an older child who might have troubles with generalized anxiety and be worried in many situations, to a child with social anxiety, which is a type of severe shyness that is so severe it gets in the way of their school performance and gets in the way of making normal friendships and relationships. The wonderful thing, however, is that although anxiety is very common, it's actually a very treatable condition. And there are things that we can teach parents to do in order to help their kids with the anxiety. And there's also very effective treatments like talk therapy, such as cognitive behavior therapy. And then in certain cases, medications may be helpful as well if other things have been tried and they haven't been helpful. I would preface that by saying, in general, when you have a child with anxiety, we start with just very basic holistic things first, actually. We first make sure that the child is eating well and has a proper nutritious diet. We make sure the child is getting enough sleep, make sure they're getting enough exercise, and we also look at things like stress. Is the child under a lot of stress from either family stresses, like parents having some relationship issues or financial issues? Is the child under stress from school stresses, such as learning troubles or bullying or peer issues? And as much as possible, we try and help them first deal with those things. Interestingly enough, oftentimes if you can help them with those other stresses, then it gives them a chance to have their own resiliencies and their own personal strengths kick in. And often that is effective in helping them get over the anxiety without necessarily having to resort to formal cognitive behavior therapy or formal treatment per se. But definitely if they require the formal psychotherapy, then that can be very helpful as well.
You bring up a good point there, I guess. You know, a lot of times the child that's brought forward for treatment is reflecting a lot of other things that might be happening in that family system. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes. Children are part of the system. And in mental health, we often refer to patients that come to see us as not necessarily the patient, but we call them the identified patient. So often I'll see a 10-year-old child who is the what we call the identified patient. And what we're saying there is we're saying that sometimes, although the child may be the one showing the symptoms, sometimes they're actually showing the symptom and that indicates that there's distress somewhere else in the family, not necessarily just the child. Children are very sensitive, and oftentimes their behaviors reflect, you know, not an issue that is just the child's own issue, but things going on in the family. One example might be a child who is misbehaving and getting into trouble. And then when we dig deeper, we get the history that the parents are having some conflict and fighting. And the reason the child is getting into trouble is because this child is unconsciously wanting to get the parents put their attention onto the child so that they're not fighting amongst themselves. And so the core cause of the problem is really that the parents are at conflict. And the true solution is not so much teaching this child to behave better, but the true solution would be actually family therapy in order to get the parents to either repair the relationship or move on. And by reducing that parent conflict, then the child can have less issues. So that would be a very classic example.
That sort of fits with what both Giuseppe and I do. We both work as family therapists. And you've got some information up there on drchang.ca that gives some general information about anxiety. Are there some situations where, you know, if a parent's concerned about their child's level of worry, are there things that in general might be helpful?
First, I'm flattered that you saw those handouts. I'll be very honest, they're nothing particularly special. They're things you could get from reading any books on anxiety, but I do find them useful in my practice because oftentimes I work with families and they can't afford the books, and so I like to direct them to those handouts. But to answer your question, yes, there are a lot of simple strategies that parents can use in order to help their child with anxiety. One of the general principles would be for parents to be able to have a good communication with their child in order to be able to ask their child about what makes them anxious in particular. So if the child is saying, I don't want to go to school, I'm feeling really nervous, I don't want to go to school, I'm having headaches and stomach aches, if the parent suspects anxiety, then the parent can say, well, tell me a bit more, it looks like you don't want to go to school, what is it about school that's stressful? What is it about school that makes you anxious or that makes you not want to go? And then sometimes the child will say, I really don't know, it's just everything about school is stressful. So then the parent could ask things more specifically and say, well, you know, one thing that might be anxious about school is, you know, is it the schoolwork? Is it the teachers? Is it a classmate? And then if the child says something like, well, I don't want to go to school because of all the bullying, then bingo, we can ask more about bullying, and then that gives us an idea that bullying is something we'll need to intervene on in order to help this child with their anxiety. So it's very important to be able to talk about what might be triggering the anxiety in the child, because we can do all sorts of wonderful things like deep breathing and yoga interventions and cognitive behavior therapy, but if the core issue is something like bullying, then we need to address that.
So communication is the first step, and then you can start working on some problem solving.
Exactly.
Now, I know one of the things that you've had an interest in, and it's something that I was also looking at some of your research articles today, is, and this can be linked to anxiety too, are kids with sensory processing problems.
That's right.
Can you tell us a little bit about what those are?
We all have senses, and for most of us, we are able to tolerate the normal amount of senses that we get in a typical day. We might get on the school bus, and we can tolerate the sounds on the school bus. We get to work, and we can tolerate the sounds around us in the classroom or at work. But there are some kids out there who are hypersensitive in the way that they perceive senses, and they have what we call sensory hypersensitivities. It is estimated that about 5 to 10% of what we call neurotypical or quote, normal people may have some sensitivities, but in a small percentage of people, these sensitivities can be so severe that it causes day-to-day problems in their life. And classic examples of kids who may have these issues are kids with autistic spectrum disorders or kids with learning disorders or kids with ADHD, but a lot of the so-called normal population has these issues as well. So I'll give you some common examples. I'll ask the two of you, do any of you have any sensitivities to tags on your clothing?
I'm not a big fan of tags. In fact, if I see a t-shirt that doesn't have a tag in it, I'm more likely to pick that one up than one that does.
I got to tell you, I love tags, so it's not...
it's You're not sensitive to tags,
Giuseppe.
It's
not a problem for me.
Okay, so I'm glad to see that it sounds like one of you is sensitive.
That's right.
And in some people, that sensitivity to touch is so extreme that it causes problems. So, you know, imagine going to work or going to school, and imagine your clothes felt like they were made out of sandpaper, you know. And if anyone touched you the wrong way, it would make that sandpaper rub into you. That's what it's like for a kid who may have some hypersensitivity to touch. And for such a kid with hypersensitivity to touch, if someone just as so much bumps into them, it's like being hit or struck. And these kids can actually get angry or just become completely overwhelmed, even just from the normal bumping and jostling in the classroom. So that would be an example of touch hypersensitivity. And their parents will tell us that they don't like being touched, they've never liked any sort of physical affection, and you have to stay away from them or they get angry or upset. Another important type of sensory hypersensitivity is actually sound.
Mm-hmm.
So let's say you guys had to do some work, or let's say you were studying. How would you be if I told you that, you know, you had to study in a loud, noisy bar?
Not good.
Would you be able to get much work done?
Wouldn't work.
But if I forced you to do that, let's say I forced you to be in that bar all day long, you'd probably be pretty annoyed and irritable at the end of that day, right?
Yes.
And then when you get home, you probably wouldn't be in the best of mood. So for a kid with sensory hypersensitivity to noise, being in just a normal classroom environment or being in just a normal work environment to them is like us being in a very loud, noisy environment. So these kids or their parents will tell us that, yeah, he just, you know, is always on edge if it's too loud, and he's always irritable if it's too loud. And I know that all of us are like this to a degree, but with these kids, they're like this even with normal sound.
I like this idea of there being a continuum and that people have different sensitivities along that continuum. And, you know, the typical thing we hear, I guess, with autistic kids, for instance, is the more extreme sounds that they're sensitive to. So when the school bell goes off,
That's right.
You know, they really, really upsets them, and there's things put into place to prevent that kind of situation from happening.
That's right. I like the way you mentioned it being on a continuum. So there, all of us are somewhere on that continuum. You know, some of us are more sensitive, some of us are less sensitive, but there's a wide range. So just the other week, I saw a kid with sound sensitivity, and it turns out that this kid couldn't focus in the classroom because the buzz of the fluorescent lights made it impossible for her to focus. And the analogy with you would be, you know, if you had a loud, you know, radio turned on in your office during your sessions, you probably wouldn't be able to get anything done because of that noise. But mm-hmm. that was what it was like for her with the buzzing of that fluorescent light. So things got better when they changed the light and it wasn't buzzing anymore. But what was very interesting is that unless you ask these kids or unless you ask these parents specifically about each of these senses, you won't really know. Because they'll often say to you, well, doesn't everyone else notice the same thing or doesn't everyone else react the same way? And then they're often quite surprised when we tell them, no, actually, most other people really aren't that sensitive to tags. So far, I've talked about sensory sensitivities as being one of the types of problems we can see in people. My guess, my theory, is that the reason we have these traits in our society is probably because at some level it is helpful to have some of these traits. If we look at how we evolved living in villages and we had dangers at night and we had wild creatures that could threaten our survival, you can imagine that it would probably be very helpful to have people who were very sensitive to noise because then they could wake up and alert everyone else in the village. Oftentimes we talk about things being disorders, but having just enough of these traits is actually a helpful thing. And the same thing goes true for anxiety, too. It's important that we have just enough anxiety, because if we didn't have any anxiety at all, then we would probably do a lot of things without thinking first about the danger.
I guess the whole idea is that if it's helping your performance, if it's helping you get along in life, it's a good thing. And once it becomes, when you talk about a disorder, that's when there's too much of it and it's interfering with your day-to-day life and your ability to get along in the world.
Yes, exactly, exactly. And so that philosophy and approach is really helpful, I find, when we're working with people. When I work with someone with obsessive-compulsive disorder, which is a condition where they have habits which they cannot stop doing, and the classic habit they cannot stop doing is washing their hands over and over again. But having just enough of that trait is actually helpful. If you became a surgeon, it's actually really good to be someone who wants to wash their hands all the time, because then you'll lower your rate of infection and you'll be a better doctor.
And we also pulled up an article you co-wrote with a colleague. It gives a sense of the kinds of treatment in that particular case, and I think that might be instructive for people to hear.
So, if memory serves, it was a 9-year-old child, and I was asked to see this child for query bipolar disorder, which is a condition where people have rages and troubles with mood swings. It was sad, actually, because by the time he'd come to see me, he'd seen multiple doctors, multiple specialists, and they all felt that his rages were due to bipolar disorder. And usually when people think bipolar disorder, they think medication. So he had actually been tried on a wide variety of medications for a possibility of bipolar disorder. And unfortunately, none of these medications worked. So he was sent to see me to see what other medications we might be able to put him on. This is a child who is very intelligent, very smart, but he was always having rages. And when you ask the parents what would set him off, they would say, everything. What do you mean by everything? Well, in the morning when we, you know, make him get up and make him wash his face, wash his hair, brush his teeth, that makes him have a tantrum and a rage. When we put him on the school bus to get him to go to school, he has rages on the school bus. When he's in the classroom environment with 30 kids in the class, he has rages. And if anyone touches him, he, you know, has a rage and he'll belt them. So when we actually broke it down, it turns out that all of his rages were actually triggered by sensory issues. Once I realized that he was being triggered by sensory issues, like too much sound or mm-hmm. too much touch or too much light, I actually simply referred him to an occupational therapist. They did their sensory assessment, gave them a questionnaire called a sensory profile, and they were able to determine which sensory issues triggered him, and they were able to put together a therapeutic program in order to desensitize him and help him better function in the school. So my advice to parents is, if you have a child who has rages or a child who is overwhelmed, think about things like, is it being touched that's setting this off? Is it too much noise? Is it too much light? Is it too much sound? And if you suspect these things are the case, then read up about sensory processing issues and have your child see an occupational therapist.
Do you have a book that you would recommend for parents about the subject?
Actually, I would like to recommend a website. There's an excellent website. It's called, you know what, I'll just ask parents to Google this. It's called the SPD Foundation. And the SPD Foundation stands for Sensory Processing Disorder Foundation. They're located in Colorado. It's headed by Dr. Lucy Miller. She is an occupational therapist with a PhD. And she is the world leader and world advocate in bringing attention and knowledge to this condition. They've been featured on Time magazine. They've been on, you know, NBC News and The Morning Show. And it is something which people are becoming more and more aware about.
Well, we'll put a link to the site in the notes for our show when we post it on the website.
Excellent. That would be wonderful.
Yeah, and I guess the other thing about it is that there's, it's not currently in the diagnostic manual, but I understand that they're considering it for the revised version.
Exactly.
It seems to have a lot of overlap with a number of different other disorders that are in the manual.
I think we can actually conceptualize a lot of conditions as being disorders of regulation. So one of the big overlaps we see in sensory processing disorder is it does overlap with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. Mm-hmm. One of the things about ADHD, or attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, is if you think about each of the senses, in ADHD, people have distractibility with sound, so they're sensitive to sound. In ADHD, another sense that they have issues with is that they need to move all the time.
Mm-hmm.
They have what we call high vestibular seeking behaviors, or they have what we call vestibular hyposensitivity.
So they're less sensitive to things like movement, and they really need to move more.
Exactly. So I know, you know, when we went to school and we learned about the senses, we didn't really learn about movement as a sense, but you can think of movement as a sense. And so kids with ADHD need to seek out movement. And what's very fascinating is a lot of the non-medication strategies for ADHD basically mimic a lot of the strategies that occupational therapists would use for sensory processing disorders. You know, the usual strategy we use for ADHD and the need for movement is we give them inflatable cushions to sit on so they can move. We tell them to fidget more. We may give them what we call weighted blankets or weighted vests or weighted stuffed animals in order to give them a sense of deep pressure, which is soothing and seems to help a lot of them focus better. So I guess the point I'm trying to make is that in understanding our sensory systems and in using the knowledge that occupational therapists bring to this, it is giving us a lot more options in helping these conditions than what we used to do. In my practice of being a child psychiatrist, you know, 10 years ago, the main treatment we had for ADHD was put the kid at the front of the class and give them medications.
Mm-hmm.
But thanks to occupational therapists and sensory processing interventions, we have a lot more options.
Now, I don't want to let you go without talking about ementalhealth.ca.
Oh, I'm touched. Thank you.
Yeah, it's something that you helped start. And it's a internet resource for mental health consumers and professionals, and it links people to resources in their own communities. So tell us a little bit more about eMental Health and how you came to be involved with it.
Being in mental health in early 2000, I was always getting questions about where to go for help. I would get these questions from patients I would see, and I would get these questions from people in my personal life. You know, you go to a party, someone finds out you're in mental health, and then they'll ask you. They'll say, oh, my daughter has this issue. Where can I go for help? Who do you recommend I see? And I'm sure the two of you encounter this issue all the time, right?
Absolutely.
Right.
You know, you cannot go to a party and meet people tell them that you're in mental health, and then have them not at some point ask you some questions.
They'll come around at some time during the evening when they're relaxed.
Exactly.
And tell you, oh, you could write a book about my family, they'll say.
Exactly. Because we were always getting questions about where to go for help, we realized, well, given that we live in this internet age, you'd think that there should be a website where people could just go and find out where to get help. But back in 2005, there was unfortunately nothing like that. So that's why we decided to build eMental Health. It was a website that would have listings of mental health resources and services for people of all ages, and it would make it easy for anyone to find out where to get help. The original pilot was so successful that we have now since expanded from Ottawa to other neighboring counties and communities. And the project since last year is now an initiative of the Provincial Center of Excellence for Child and Youth Mental Health. So we are able to now expand eMental Health and make it better.
So in Ottawa now and in other communities around the province, parents or anyone really can go online, find out about where to get help for particular difficulties, and even find out about some events related to mental health issues, right?
That's right. The site is really mainly based in Ottawa. So we have the largest database of resources for Ottawa. But we are growing, and even in areas where we haven't yet grown to, you can still use eMental Health and find out about some of the general resources in your area. So let's say you're a parent and your child is having some problems with eating and you're wondering if they have an eating disorder. Well, you can actually go to eMental Health, and if you look at the right side of the screen and scroll down, we have a section called Mental Health Checkup. And on Mental Health Checkups section, we have a variety of validated, scientifically proven screening tools for various conditions. So if you're wondering if your child has an eating disorder, you can click on that link, and then you'll be able to fill out some questions asking about certain eating disorder symptoms. And if those symptoms are positive, then eMental Health will then tell you where in your area you can find help. If you're wondering if your child has an anxiety disorder, if you're wondering if your husband has PTSD or post-traumatic stress disorder, or if you're wondering if you have obsessive-compulsive disorder, we have questionnaires for most of these main conditions. So I find this very helpful because oftentimes people have an issue and they find it too hard to go see their family doctor if they have one, or they have to have a long wait to see their family doctor. The incredible thing is, thanks to the internet, now they can just go on this website and they can get a pretty good idea of themselves, whether or not they have an issue and where they can get help for it. Unfortunately, there is stigma about mental health, and a lot of people do feel more comfortable looking for information or searching for information in the privacy of their own home. You know, myself included, there's many things I would rather Google first before I ask my family doctor about, and I think that's, just the way things are nowadays. But from our point of view as health professionals, if we can have people empower themselves and get help 24/7 off a website, then that frees up other resources so we can do other things for those people who can't benefit from the websites.
Dr. Chang, it's definitely an excellent resource, and we want to thank you so much for joining us tonight. What's the best way for our listeners to get in touch with you or to track you down?
I'm afraid that with my current work at CHEO, it does make it hard for me to have time to just respond to requests. But I guess, given the excellent work that you guys are doing in educating people, I guess what I'll say is this: if people do want to read up about things, just go to eMental Health, I'll say. And then if you have questions about the website, you can contact us through the website. I would say that if you are in Ottawa and you are looking for mental health help for your child, unfortunately, I can't take any direct questions about mental health help. But definitely, if you have a child and you're wanting mental health help for them, you can always go to your family doctor and have them do a referral to CHEO, if that's indicated.
That's exactly what we suggest to our listeners, for sure. And what we'll do is we'll put ementalhealth.ca up as our website of the week, so we'll link to that in addition to the SPD Foundation. Once again, it's been great talking to you, Dr. Chang. Thank you so much.
It's been great talking to the two of you guys as well. I wish you an awesome week.
Thanks a lot, Michael. It's been great having you on the show. And that's it for us for this week. You can email us at info@familyanatomy.com or visit our website at familyanatomy.com. And as always, Dr. Brian has an announcement.
You just listened to it. Episode 99 is in the can. So if you want to promote the show, you can vote for us at Podcast Alley. You can leave us a review on iTunes. You can comment on other blogs. You can link to our stories. You can share them on Facebook. We love to have your comments too. Email us or leave us a comment on the website. As usual tonight, though, we're going to leave you with a bit of a tune by Brother Love. He's not at ementalhealth.ca, but he is at brotherloverocks.com.
Thanks for listening. So get up and sing. It's a family thing. Hey! You know what to do. FamilyAnatomy.com